Hi, and welcome to the Inside Out Security Show. I'm your very sick host, Cindy Ng, and the show must go on. So I'm joined by security practitioners, Killian, Mike, and Forrest, and our icebreaker question is based on a tweet that the biggest risk in technology is that we build things that nobody wants to use. And another user said, no, the biggest risk in technology is that we build things that hurt the people who use them. I'm wondering what you think the biggest risk in technology is and why.
I think it's that we build things that can be exploited. And we see that a lot, that there's always a lot of naivete about building tools and then they have unexpected uses. Twitter started as this very like kind of fun, silly thing, and then it's been used for a lot of abuses. Email is great to communicate with, and then everyone gets, you know, swamped in spam. IoT devices are great, but then, you know, people harness them for denial of service attacks across the internet. All these unintended consequences.
Hi, this is Killian. I would tend to agree with Mike on that point as well. And I think this is maybe a recurring theme throughout our show is that we become so focused on, you know, if we can do something, we never stop to think if we should do something. If I can quote Jurassic Park in every episode, I'm going to try, but Mike kind of hit the nail on the head. We're always trying to hopefully do great things as we invent these new technologies, but we have to start to consider that there's off-label use for it. People are going to find a way to exploit any system, you know, use it for their own ends, and they're not always on the up and up. It's a sad state that we have to kind of think that way, but probably for the long term, it's the safest way to approach it, at least.
Yeah, this is Forrest, and I agree about the unintended consequences, but I don't want to limit it to just potential exploits, basically, or like off-label uses, you know, like Killian said. I mean, I would say that kind of like the actual, was it the second tweet that we saw about things that, you know, hurt the people who use them? I mean, things that have sort of externalities to them that you know, maybe they work as intended perfectly, but there's, you know, second or third order effects. IoT devices, aside from being exploited, I don't know, maybe bringing potentially later on exploited things into, you know, homes more pervasively is something that has negative effects we just haven't seen yet or even considered.
Just to contradict myself a little bit too and provide both sides of the argument, we can also kind of say that technology could be used for unintended consequences for good as well. You know, think about the internet as we know it today. How much good that delivers connecting people around the world. And it had modest beginnings, you know, in government and university work for very specific reasons. And I don't think they ever intended it to be this distributed and have the positive effects it has in society as well, too. So both unintended consequences, but very different outcomes.
Thanks, guys. And for our regular listeners, please don't go on iTunes to rate and review the podcast. The last thing I would want is to get a bad review.
Because of your voice or just like in general?
Because of my voice.
Okay.
So let's just dive into the show this week. As we think about risk, different people will have different ideas about what risk will mean to them. And depending on the consequence, we'll expect to get a different reasoning behind each decision. So let's do a little bit of reasoning with a few headlines we've seen lately. So let's start with the alleged Capital One data leak. When the vendor left a whole bunch of sensitive data on an unsecure server, what does this mean? Tell us about what's at risk, how to remediate this problem, if that's the case. Take us through what went wrong, what's going on in between the he said, she said.
This is Killian. The first thing I thought on this one, and it wasn't entirely clear from the article that we're referencing, is where they got this data and why they moved it up there in the first place. What it seems to me is, and again, if somebody else knows a little bit more, happy to be enlightened, but what it seems like is that the third-party company who moved this data up there didn't know what they were moving or dealing with. That seems like the easiest explanation. They had a pile of data that they'd get from one place to the other, and they didn't maybe realize that the contents were so sensitive. And because of that, they didn't take any precautions. So I think that's the biggest takeaway, at least for me, is that there's always unintended risk, especially if the information or the data, whatever happens to be you're dealing with, contains, you know, sensitive information you're not aware of. It's kind of just like a trap waiting for you at that point. And it's something that we have to be constantly aware of and thinking about when dealing with data.
And this is Mike. So a couple things with this. One, I think this goes to a lot of the issues with how foreign using services like AWS are in terms of storage, where it's not entirely clear why this particular, you know, S3 bucket, which is what it seems like it was, you know, had this separately. There's a lot of things that I think, you know, we sort of cargo cult in the security world, things such as, you know, password changing that over time. Like, why do you have to do that? Well, it's if your password's compromised, you don't know it and you change it, then suddenly the old one becomes invalid. And that's a lot of the situation with these things, like we're worried about private keys being exposed, et cetera. There's, I think, in general, a good policy is to, you know, rotate those things on a periodic basis, as often as you can take, and to automate them so it's easy, so it actually gets done.
Yeah, this is far as the only thing that really stands out to me, aside from what was already said, was it seems like some of the logic or explanation for, you know, why no customer data would have been exposed is really just explaining what their policy was about how, as default settings, including credentials, are changed after deploying or before deploying third-party software, which may be true. It's just really interesting to me that the sort of explanation of what their policy is meant to tell us that it was met. And in my experience, there's a big difference between, you know, having your policy in place and then really, truly, consistently using it. So I'm not necessarily saying that this is something to doubt right here. I just find it interesting that was their explanation and not necessarily just that they actually did follow that policy.
I think there is something to be said, especially for large, complex organizations, that there are very different segments to the business, even though it's all IT. You can imagine in the marketing group, we have a marketing website. We have basically a website with HubSpot that all it does is landing pages that people want white papers. Like, that is a very different system than, you know, our billing system, our accounting, our customers data. And if HubSpot was compromised and someone got access to that website, that's a very different risk than it is a different one and much less important.
What's your implication here for the policy? Are you saying that, kind of falling back to Forrest's point, you know, relying on that policy for everything, are you taking a stand that, you know, we should not worry about it so much or not be as strict in enforcing the, you know, password and policy because the HubSpot pages is less sensitive?
I guess neither of those. I think what it is that we need to speak precisely about these things, and that it's not enough to say, oh, Capital One's data got exposed. Like, you know, in a company that literally probably has thousands of servers, thousands of different services, it's just there's a very different situation if your central data store gets taken over versus a Dropbox that you let, you know, third-party vendors upload spreadsheets to occasionally. Like, those are, I think everyone understands that those are very different things. And it's very different to have, oh, the private key for, you know, this third-party service that we occasionally use has been taken versus, oh, the private key that we use for the SSL or the main login for the actual banking is taken. And there is room for nuance in there, and there's room for legitimate discussion. And I don't think it really helps anyone to, you know, say, oh, this is horrible, or I'm just talking, let's talk the details, as, you know, tough as that is. Unlike Killian, who slanders everyone. Thank you. So.
The next study on risk is the request for 2.4 million Google takedown requests under the right to be forgotten option in the EU. What are some risks for Google to remove so much content, and also risks for the end user if they don't remove that content, and if they do? Let's talk about the pros and cons for each of the instances.
Mike's lucky that I'm not an EU citizen, because I would have this podcast taken down for him slandering me a second ago, implying that I slander people.
You know, a quick proxy, a VPN located in, you know, Paris. We can make this happen. We can make it look like you're an EU citizen, Killian. Honestly, your name sounds way more European than mine. So I think you pull this off. You don't have to do much. One issue, and this sort of goes back to the thing we just talked about, was that we need to talk in detail. And 2.4 million is a lot. It's a lot for, you know, if I was given that much money, it's a lot if I had that many parking tickets, if I had that many bowls of macaroni and cheese for lunch. Like, that is a big number. I don't know if it's a big number for Google in terms of how much information they had. And I especially don't know if it's a big number if it's what I assume is that it's particular individual situations that each have a whole bunch of pages that they want to be taken down. There's a Michael Buckby, who's not me, who passed away a number of years ago, and some of his Google search results come up for me. He was apparently not a very nice individual, but I'd hate to, you know, have that conflated with my own life. So I could see, you know, oh, it'd be nice to take some of that down. So I think it can go both ways.
How do you balance the risk of that? And that's a great example with, you know, the public's right to know information about people. Think about hiring directors and things like that, who it's pretty commonplace, at least here in the U.S., to do background checks and research on employees before they hire someone to make sure that, you know, they're of good character, they're not misrepresenting themselves and things like that. What do you think the potential damage is, you know, if a disreputable person decided that, you know, they don't like missing out on the big job because of background issues or past things that they're not proud of or they've done?
I'm conflicted. I do think there's a good chance that all of us that are over a certain age would not have the jobs we are if the internet had been around, because we all would have been recorded doing something silly or crazy. We're having a windstorm right now, and my wife was almost knocked out by the recycling bin in the street. What she said to me was, there were teenagers teenagers at the bus stop. I worried they were going to take a video of me being blown down the street by the windstorm, and that would be my legacy. And, you know, that's a silly thing. I mean, that's not convictions or anything else, but it could still be impactful on her life, and she wouldn't want that. Or we had a real weird situation where someone created a Twitter account with her name that was for very not safe for work activities. You could tell it was just a bot that scraped a whole bunch of different names trying to fake stuff out. And so, you know, really wanted that to be taken down. So I think it cuts both ways. And I'm not entirely sure this is a security issue, though, potentially.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily go as far as to say it is a security issue either. But think about it, and I'm this is a fairly big stretch here, but think about how much we rely on our identity for other things in our life. Think about, you know, credit reporting, for example. It's a Herculean task and almost impossible in many senses to get that changed if someone's used your information inappropriately and opened accounts and kind of ruined it. So again, I'm kind of swinging the pendulum back the other direction here. Wouldn't it be great if there was an easier way to get things changed that are erroneous?
I'm, I don't even know this, intimately familiar with this, seeing as my name is the same as a level in Zelda Ocarina of Time, and therefore Googling Forest Temple results mostly in walkthroughs of a video game and children arguing on message boards. I'm, you know, pretty intimately familiar with this. I mean, that was mostly a joke, but truth is, that is really what you get when you Google my name. But I don't know. I mean, I think that a couple years ago when the European courts like made the right to be forgotten, it honestly seemed like a fair balancing act of there being some due process, basically, you know, some responsibility for, you know, corporations that, you know, have the ability to do so. I mean, Google's probably the biggest one, but, you know, it's clearly, I mean, I think the stats from this Google announcement were like only 43% of them were followed through on, you know, because a lot of them were people who kind of didn't understand what Google was actually hosting and what was just other websites Google was referencing, things like that. I don't know, I mean, I think we're going down a road of an appropriate level of you have the ability to remove things that are inappropriately potentially damaging you. But beyond that, I mean, like there is, you know, like you mentioned, the right to be able to have some access to information. And I do think that honestly, like the courts, European courts at least, you know, are doing a pretty good job, I think, of like exploring what that means, because this is a new concept. You know, I mean, there's going to be like some sort of ethical error and some, you know, ethical success. And I hope they continue to go down the right path.
Well, you convinced me not to name my kids Water Temple Buckby and Fire Temple Buckby, which was really what we were going for. But now it just seems too risky. So,
yeah, there you go. If I've taught anyone anything today, I hope it's that.
There was a really interesting article about how companies are embracing analytics, but that they still don't have a data-driven culture. And it's interesting to read that companies aren't leveraging data to assist with their business decisions. And do you really think that that's true, that they're not using data? What does a data-driven culture look like? And can you always trust the data that you're fed?
So there was a really interesting article about a gentleman quitting Google this week to work on his own. And part of his issue was that in the promotion scheme, they have a lot of metrics. And so he was working on something that really was in between two milestones that helped out other people and was a big impact on the company as a whole, but his own personal metrics didn't go up. And so he kept being passed over for promotion. And I'm paraphrasing a bunch of stuff in there, but that comes up in a lot of different scenarios and, you know, in factories where, you know, there's really good data about like how many parts and widgets were made per hour and like what was the defect rate. And there's still, without knowing everything, it's really hard to make good decisions. And there's lots of sort of perverse incentives that can be brought in. And that's the tricky part about data, that it can be both useful and it can be harmful at the same time, depending upon how it's applied. So I don't think it's as simple as saying, oh, we need data.
I'm actually kind of shocked a little bit by the results of that survey. If we look at, and again, so much that we talk about in previous episodes of this show and so many things that we read in the different articles really would lead me to believe that things are much more data-driven anymore. If you look at, again, the Googles, the Facebooks, Amazon, any of these other web services companies, they seem to be very data-driven, making decisions about, you know, what products to feature or what recommendations to make for you and, you know, what videos you should watch and things like that on Netflix. So I'm kind of surprised that the same processes that have driven such success in a lot of organizations have not been applied internally. But I think to, you know, maybe Mike's point, it seems like if they're not, it could possibly be because they don't know how to make that balancing act work internally. it's much easier to gather the right data and make or apply it correctly, you know, with web searches and things like that, which are, I would think, fairly unbiased in terms of, you know, what a user is looking at, things like that, as opposed to the much more nuanced activities that would take place in a business. In Mike's example, you know, how do you measure a certain level of productivity, for example? Is it the amount of emails that you do? Is it the amount of words you write? Is it the amount of meetings that you set? Or is it the amount of, you know, deals you close? These are all potential metrics, but striking that balance to decide who's actually successful could be potentially very difficult because you lack some of the context you need.
So here's a quote from this that sums this up. So this guy, his name was Michael Lynch, and he was working on, and this is somewhat ironic, a legacy data pipeline. So this is something moving information between two systems. And so he says, the pipeline didn't record many metrics. The ones it did have made it look like things had gotten worse. My bug discoveries caused the overall bug count to increase. The pipeline's failure increased because I made it fail fast on anomalies instead of silently passing along bad data. So, you know, he took the situation and said, like, oh, instead of, like, you know, he actually was solving problems and raising issues. And of course, that made it look worse. So that's the answer. Don't fix things.
Well, that's the last thing you want to do. And even worse, don't under any circumstances try to anticipate problems before they arise. That would be problem number one. Absolutely.
Problem number zero, perhaps.
Yeah, that's actually more accurate.
Problem number, we're just going to let this go. We're not going to write a number down for it because then we can be held accountable.
Can you go problem negative one?
That's part of the QA testing to see if, like, negative numbers or values over 256, you know, cause it to freak out.
Divide by zero.
Yeah.
I will say, so that kind of concept where, like, bringing up problems can make it look like there were more problems, or recognizing that there are problems makes it seem like you're inventing new problems. I mean, that's something that I feel like has existed for, I don't even know, like, since the beginning of, like, you know, industrial, you know, whatever processes, right? So my feeling is that, okay, well, you know, if you have someone who's potentially creating, like, you know, incentives to not bring up problems, I mean, I don't know if they followed through on that incentive or not, but if they're, you know, experiencing that, that's actually, I think, a metric and, you know, ties into some of the, maybe not quite analytics, but some of the metrics here that I think started some of the big data and analytics, you know, development eventually, and, you know, kind of like it says, like, into a continuum on over to AI eventually. And I mean, like, that started with metrics, right? And so, I mean, like, this is a problem of, you know, recognizing problems that's probably existed since, like, the first assembly lines, you know, or whatever, you know, who wanted to bring up a problem and have it be on them? I mean, you hear about that in other industries too. Thankfully, I think in this scenario, at least this is measured and we're seeing it in an analyzed situation.
Well, you'd think the metric that they should be measuring, and again, I don't know all the details, of course, but it should be the data quality. That you'd think would be the biggest metric. I don't know exactly how you measure that, but it sounds like this guy was finding problems with, you know, the data in the pipeline as it came over, whatever that might have been. But you think of the downstream effects. If they're getting bad data into the system, they're using it for analysis and business decisions in some other aspect of the business, it's providing them flawed answers. So you'd think that that type of quality assurance in the data itself should have been the metric by which they were measuring. But, you know, then again, the self-awareness to know that, you know, you don't have a problem or you do have a problem, you don't realize it, is something I think that, at least in technology, we often overlook. We assume that, you know, the data that we have or we're operating in perfect conditions when, unfortunately, reality is a lot more messy and nuanced than that.
Or maybe also be self-aware enough to know that you're not a metric. You're more than just a number. So there's a great article on best practices for user account authorization and password management. And I love best practices, but if you're an IT admin and you're weighing the risks of what to do for your company, I think advice like this, it can sometimes be conflicting. And how do you align the best practice with the risks against the company? And by the way, this dovetails nicely with Tom's IT Pro article on balancing security and user productivity. What are your comments?
I think with everything else, and I think almost everything that we've talked about in the show so far, there is that balancing act. Having to again, have an outcome, you know, in this case, the security of whatever systems connected to the passwords and using those best practices and trying to refine them. Now, it might potentially cause a little bit of headache early on, at least. Again, even in the example of the Google guy who quit, he identified an issue with the system and went to correct it. In a similar way, implementing these password policies could look like there are more problems than there really are and more headache in the process. But overall, the metric I think that people should be measuring is, again, the risk reduction. Now, whatever that means for the company is sometimes hard to quantify, which is, I think, maybe a completely different problem in itself. I think nobody's really wrapped their head around a good way to quantify risk because of the many different variables. Mike, time to disagree.
Well, I just want to say I really like this stuff. We're talking about, you know, trying to get down to brass tacks, get down to the details of things, and having, you know, a clear set of guidelines and a checklist. Just, it makes things so much more comparable and so much less wishy-washy as far as these things. So I like it quite a bit. And that doesn't mean that it's perfect, but it does mean that you can at least have a decent conversation and keep things going. And with so much of this, where there's so much complexity, having, you know, every one of these tips could be, you know, switched around into, you know, a book of practices about how to implement it. But to have it at such a high level is something very easy to point to, and I think helps the industry and helps everyone out.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, something like this, I know there was just kind of like a combination of two articles here, but the one that was the kind of 12-point list, that one actually I thought was really great. I mean, one paragraph each, and you know, if you were to hit these, great baseline, you have a great starting point.
You know what, Forrest, though, you know, you're bringing up all these issues with our password management scheme, and you know, those are really going to ding your metrics.
We have a tool of the week.
Yes. This week, the tool is BetterCap. And so BetterCap is a man in the middle framework. So what it does is it lets you push traffic through it and then examine that traffic. So this is something that's useful for a lot of different things. A lot of services use this too, or a lot of researchers use this. So you have an iOS app and you're trying to test the security of it. You can push all the traffic through something like this and see like, oh, here's what's happening. It's going to these servers. It's under, they're SSLing it, but we can, you know, take that out. We can strip it. We can do all this stuff. So it's a neat security research tool. And what's really interesting about this version is that it's all upgraded and rewritten in Go, Golang. So it's much faster, which lets you use it in a much broader way, almost like if you were trying to handle, you know, all the traffic on a network and look at all of it. If you try to do that with a lot of the previous BetterCap or other tools, it'd be very slow, and this one can handle a ridiculous amount of traffic comparatively. So BetterCap 2.0, it's open source, and I think we'll have the link in the show notes.
Thanks to Mike Buckby, Forrest Temple, Killian Engler, and all our listeners for joining us today. Thanks, and we'll meet up again soon.
Take care, everyone.
Thanks. Feel better, Cindy. Bye.
Bye, everyone.